The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, and today I'm talking to Michael Weir, who was the Director of Faith Outreach for Barack Obama. He worked in the White House, where he led evangelical outreach and helped manage the President's engagement on religious and values issues. He's now the author of Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House, about the future of faith in America. Michael, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
So what's it like working in the White House? Is it like the West Wing?
Like the television show?
Like the television show.
I'll tell you, the West Wing is a lot closer to reality than Scandal.
Really?
So I'll give you that. I had a London taxi driver yesterday who was asking me, why do people in D.C. always meet on park benches? Can't you meet in an office?
Yes.
And I said, we don't meet in park benches all the time. So the West Wing is very is good. People are not that funny
at
the White House.
Okay.
And they don't talk as much. But other than that, West Wing gives a pretty good feel. I mean, it's an immense honor to work there.
Of course.
Everywhere are reminders of history and of the weight of the office of the presidency, and so you never forget that you're working there.
Of course,
And so it was a very humbling experience.
Yeah. So we like to go back right to the beginning here on The Profile and talk about people's upbringing and sort of where they're coming from. You grew up in Buffalo in New York. What are your memories of childhood?
So I had a interesting childhood. My parents were divorced when I was five, and so was my mother, my sister, and I. I was always surrounded by a big, loving Italian family.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather played a critical role in my life. He was basically my father. Played the role of father in my life. He was Greatest Generation, fought in World War II, came back and was the head of his local union, and just a very civically minded, decent man.
Mm.
Religion didn't play a large role. In Buffalo, which is part of what they call the Rust Belt, it's a lot of Italian and Irish immigrants. It's very Catholic, mm-hmm. Culturally,
mm-hmm.
But there wasn't much theological depth in our Catholicism. I tell people, like our favorite saints were determined by which saint was associated with the best food. And so I was a Saint Joseph guy because he had these great cookies. You know, my childhood had a lot of instability, but as I get older, what I remember is the sacrifices that my mother made to just get us through,
mm-hmm.
And the love of my grandfather and the idea that that was the grounding force in my childhood.
Sure. You mentioned in the book that your generation was the first to grow up in a kind of culture where secularism is so prevalent and kind of accepted in mainstream culture. So did that kind of have an effect on you or stop you in some way from embracing Christianity or any kind of faith?
Yeah, well, so I was not just indifferent about religion. I was antagonistic.
Mm.
And largely it was because the cultural messages I was receiving gives you all these trite cliches that are sort of pseudo-intellectual things to say about religion. Oh, religion's a crutch.
Right.
It's for people who can't face reality. And so, you know, as an adolescent, and without sort of solid theological teaching that I was receiving through family or other sources, and not only is it easy to repeat those things, but when it's affirmed in the culture, then there's a sense of sort of rebelliousness that comes with it. My sister became a Christian a few years before I did, and she started working on me right away. I mean, it was like a homing missile. We would get in fights all the time. One time she was trying to walk me down Romans Road, and I picked up, it was her fault. She used a very big Bible. I picked it up and threw it at her.
No way.
So there were some, if she was trying to reach out to me, I was pretty stubborn.
Wow.
But she convinced me to go to her youth group meeting. I thought, I'll go and get all new ammunition to kind of show her what a big joke all of this is. And I went to the youth group, and I didn't like it at all. I couldn't fit in. They were using language I didn't understand. But on my way out, a volunteer leader there was handing out Romans. No commentary, just the text, just the book. And I just... There was a garbage next to him, but I didn't want to be rude. I'm like, I'll just take this, get out of here. And for some reason, I didn't throw it out. I took it back, and I read it that night in my bedroom, and I kept on reading it, and it changed my life.
Wow.
72 hours later, in the car with my sister when she dropped me off from some school function, I told her I gave my life to Christ, and it changed everything.
Amazing.
I mean, so Romans... Romans is a great antidote to someone who believes that there's no there, right? Okay. You can read Romans, and you could reject Paul's argument if you must, but you can't read it and say, I mean, he goes from creation to literal eternity and lays out an entire argument that you have to contend with. After you read Romans, there's no choice. You either will reject or accept what has been offered, and it changed my life.
And this was in your teens?
Yeah, so I was 15.
15, wow. Yeah. And has it been a fairly sort of straightforward journey since then, sort of haven't looked back from that moment?
Yeah, it's been, so when that happened, I understood... sort of, the language of making a decision for Christ.
Yeah.
I spent years, and it's the fundamental task of being a Christian, but I spent years without much understanding of what it means to follow Jesus in the day-to-day. And frankly, there weren't, it didn't feel like that was a primary preoccupation with much of the teaching I was hearing.
Yeah.
When I was at the White House, I won't name him, just a leader of a major organization in the U.S. Sent to our office a copy of Dallas Willard's The Divine Conspiracy. Mm. And so this was probably 2010, maybe even late 2009. I read Divine Conspiracy, and that opened up all new avenues and new ways of thinking about God and what it meant to be to follow Jesus and enter into a kingdom life in the here and now. And so that was a big moment for me. So it's been a fairly linear path of growth, but I've certainly when you first become a Christian, I was definitely ignorance on fire in those first few years. And God showed me a lot, and it's still showing me a lot.
That's wonderful. So at what point did you know that you were called to go into the sort of political realm?
Well, it was odd because when I first became a Christian, I was already interested in politics because of my grandfather's influence, because I was just drawn to it. Civil rights, as I describe in the book, were very important to me, even as a very young person. And then when I became a Christian, I just figured, like, well, now, like, everything has to change. So, like, I probably have to go to seminary, become a pastor, because, like, what else do Christians do? Like, what else? Like, that's a Christian thing to do. Thankfully, I had a very good pastor, and after sort of going through a process of discernment, really came to understand that I wanted to see what it meant to be faithful in public things. And so I went to D.C. for college and studied there, and then was led on a pretty incredible path that led me to the White House.
Amazing. And how did you first meet Barack Obama?
Yeah, so I was at George Washington University, and I was supposed to be leading a group of people to a Democratic Party event, the Winter Democratic Convention, which basically is the primary opportunity that candidates that will be running for president or for the party's nomination have to meet with all the superdelegates, which are basically just party bigwigs who get a vote in the primary. The problem is I had the wrong date for this convention. And so I show up to the hotel, and it's my first political convention. I mean, I think I was 18. And so it's my first political convention. So it seemed pretty dead to me, but I figured, well, I'll just walk around, open up a door, and pow, you know, a convention will be there. 20 minutes later, I finally give up, ask a receptionist, and she goes, oh, honey, that doesn't start for another couple days.
Oh, no.
So I'm dejected. I feel like a real, real idiot, and I'm leaving the hotel, and walking in towards me was Senator Barack Obama. He was coming for meetings the day or two before the convention. And because he hadn't announced, he would announce he was running for president later that month. Okay. Because he hadn't announced yet, he didn't, no Secret Service detail. Okay. He didn't have a horde of staff. So he literally walked up
just
to
him.
Me.
Yeah.
And I had followed his career was an admirer. And I told him I wanted to work for him.
Wow.
And 8 months later, I was in Iowa for the Iowa caucus.
Wow.
It was an amazing. Now I should say, you know, in that time, so it wasn't just like I met him and I met a couple staffers who were with him, and I felt really kind of strongly about it, even though I had no idea of what it would mean to even work for a presidential campaign, really. But so every couple of weeks, I'd drop an email to the staffers I met, and sometimes it would just be, you know, hey, remember me? I'm here if you need me.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes it would be, these are the three things I think you're doing wrong, and here's how I think you need to fix it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it was months of staying in touch, making sure, being humble and confident enough to put myself out there.
Yeah.
And it was that process that led to me getting a call in November asking me to come down to Iowa.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you started to work, you know, quite closely with the campaign, and there's this moment in the book where you talk about your involvement in the sit-down interview between then-Senator Obama and Pastor Rick Warren, who, of course, is the author of The Purpose-Driven Life, and well-known pastor in America. And you talk about the kind of preparation for this kind of interview between Rick Warren and Senator Obama, and including this focus on the first line of that book, The Purpose-Driven Life. The first line of that book is, "It's not about me." And you kind of honed in on this.
Yeah.
Tell us the story of exactly what happened there.
Yeah, So as the date got closer, I was wondering kind of what kind of role, if any, I would play. And as in political campaigns, people don't need anything until they need everything yesterday.
Yeah.
And so a few days before the event, I was asked to do a number of several different memos, and one of them was a synopsis of purpose-driven life and what the applications were for the conversation. And so I did that. I broke down the themes of the book, I put in this memo that the first opening lines are, "It's not about me," and you don't really know what's being read, if it's being read. I had received a call before Senator Obama walked on stage at Saddleback that he read my memo in the presidential motorcade. He wasn't president at the time, in the motorcade to the event. And so now I was really interested in what he was going to say.
Was he going to use your notes?
Yeah, right. He received a first question that was kind of like, who influences you? But then the second question was something along the lines of Pastor Rick asked, like what you had learned, what he had learned since he was a young man. And the first words out of the then senator's mouth were, something like, I had to learn, it's not about me. And he kind of winked. And there was this, and I talk about this in the book, and I kind of use it to plant seeds for some of the substantive questions I ask later in the book. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting moment of me seeing that work in politics and wondering if that was something that he resonated with from purpose-driven life, and that he read it, and that was something that he looked back on his life, and it was like, I did learn that.
Yeah.
Or if it was, I told him the opening lines of purpose-driven life, and he thought, well, that might impress Rick if he thinks I meditate on purpose-driven life every day. And so there's an important question there about how Christians, but really all people, think about political rhetoric and how it's used.
Yes.
And my book, I think, will help people work through some of those questions.
And it's a great story, and I think it's a good example of some of the other things that happen later in the book that you talk about, because it seems to be this kind of relationship of you being asked to advise and to input, and never perhaps being quite sure how much the president would pick up on or even read, and then occasionally these sort of glimpses of, oh wow, he really has picked up on something that I feel like I've had direct input into. And there are moments like that throughout the book. It's great. But I just wanted to sort of step back for a minute and ask about the wider picture, particularly in terms of Obama first being elected. So I think for a lot of people in the UK, I certainly remember he was being hailed almost as a kind of messiah figure. Like, even on this side of the pond, there was a lot of real excitement. Certainly in America, amazing scenes of sort of rejoicing when he became president. Can you help a UK audience understand exactly why there was so much joy around this election? Now, obviously, he was the first black president, and that's wonderful. But I mean, on a policy level, what was it exactly that had really captured people's imaginations?
Well, right. So he was elected to succeed a president who, at the time, had historic low approval ratings. Mm. And so part of that was just a disenchantment with the Bush presidency. Mm. And the feeling that this was a new start or a change,
right?
So that was part of it, but the big piece of it was, well, so there's a cultural critique that can be made of 21st century America that is so much about the rhetoric of progress and the rhetoric of the advance of civilization, and yet is very very preoccupied with reliving the 60s.
Okay.
And so there were many direct allusions made to the Kennedys.
Okay.
And so that sort of idea of a not just a president who was effective and smart and could do the job, but a popular culture kind of phenom. And the president had that. So it's not just that he was the first black president. It was that he was someone who could give a rousing speech. Mm. He was someone who talked about bringing people together in a way that made the American people believe him.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, John Kerry talked about bringing people together, but people looked at John Kerry and thought, this isn't... rightly or wrongly,
sure.
It didn't have the same momentum.
Yeah, there wasn't the same
it.
Charisma, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of what drove it. This sense that we're emerging from, and of course everyone didn't dislike the Bush years, but for those who did, which was a majority of the country at the time, the sense that we're emerging from a dark period into springtime.
Sure,
right?
but you know, let's apply this to, I guess, U.S. evangelicals, particularly white evangelicals, because as you will well know, historically, white evangelicals do tend to vote for the Republican Party. So people like George W. Bush, and latterly, of course, who we will come on to talk about, Donald Trump. But when, you know, Barack Obama, who is a Democrat, was running for president, and you were directing faith outreach, in a sense, you could argue your job was to get Christians who would usually vote for the other side to vote for Barack Obama. How'd you go about doing that?
Well, so I oversaw on the reelect all faith outreach, and so the president won the Catholic vote in both 2008 and 2012, obviously. His support from Hispanic Catholics and evangelicals both high. His support among Black Christians. So, all right, we're really talking about white evangelicals, which are a quarter of the American electorate, so a significant slice of the pie.
Yeah.
And then we faced antagonism and entrenched sort of suspicion or opposition from conservative Catholics. So just to sort of set that. Well, when we're talking about, I made a couple commitments when I took the faith outreach job in 2012. The most significant of which was I asked a few Republican buddies to hold me accountable. To never suggesting that Barack Obama was the candidate for people of faith.
Okay.
And so that is the kind of rhetoric that we've seen in American politics, this sort of attempt to sort of manipulate people and use faith as sort of a weapon to sort of bully people into voting for your candidate.
To say if you're a Christian, you
if
have to vote
Christian,
for this guy.
If you're a Christian, you'll vote for this guy.
Yeah.
The major temptation of mixing faith and politics, which is to declare God hath said when God has not spoken directly to the issue. So all of that to say, my goal was to advance the most compelling case for Christians and other people of faith to vote for the president based on his record.
Sure,
that could be made.
If I could dare to play a perhaps stereotypical Republican American white evangelical for a moment, I might say to someone like yourself in 2008, you know, I can't vote for Barack Obama because I'm a Christian, I'm pro-life. Perhaps I don't believe in gay marriage, or I know that wasn't an issue at the time, but okay, let's just take abortion, because that is a major issue for a lot of evangelicals. They say, I can never vote for a pro-choice candidate.
Yeah.
How did you kind of deal with that kind of a criticism? Did you try and change that mind of someone like that, or not?
So 2008 was a great campaign because... we were out for every vote, and it was a great campaign in that way. Very different from 2012, by the way, which I discuss in the book. Here's what's important to note about. It's one of the things that's important to note about the president's record. The abortion rate in America is at the lowest it's ever been since Roe v. Wade in America. This year, at the end of the Obama presidency. The other realization that had been occurring to many evangelicals. In 2008 was President Bush was elected with white evangelical support. He entered with he had a Republican Congress for much of his time, and there was no constitutional amendment to ban abortion.
No.
There was no major legislation to significantly reduce or regulate abortion during his presidency. So there was this kind of sense of, wow, we're investing so much of our and focusing so much of our political activism on this one issue, and we got basically the best case scenario that we speaking for those voters that we could imagine. And what did we get? Yeah. In the meantime, economic situation got worse, which spurred poverty and great pain across the country.
Yeah.
There were Christian criticisms of the Iraq War, of the president's environmental agenda, of the Republican Party's inability or unwillingness to move forward with immigration reform.
Yeah.
And so, we tried to offer... I was very upfront with people. Like President Obama never was and is not today pro-life. He's very pro-choice. And so we were very upfront with people about that.
But that brings us to the end of part one for now. Join us again in a moment to hear more from Michael Weir, the author of Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House about the future of faith in America. We'll be right back. But welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, and today I'm speaking to Michael Weir, who was the Director of Faith Outreach for Barack Obama. He worked in the White House, where he led evangelical outreach and helped manage the president's engagement on religious and values issues. And he's now the author of Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House about the future of faith in America. Now, Michael, I wanted to talk a bit about how Barack Obama has been perceived by Christians, because in some quarters, there was this kind of undercurrent of people claiming that Barack Obama was a Muslim. They say, you know, he's Barack Hussein Obama. But yet, you know, you do point out in the book that Obama was very explicit about his Christian faith. And you actually quote from one of his speeches, and I just thought it'd be good to hear this. So Barack Obama said that his prayer was that he might walk closer with God and make that walk my first and most important task. He went on and said, this is Barack Obama speaking, "When I wake in the morning, I wait on the Lord. I ask for him to give me the strength to do right by our country and its people. And when I go to bed at night, I wait on the Lord and I ask him to forgive me my sins and look after my family and the American people and make me an instrument of his will. I say these prayers hoping they will be answered, and I say these prayers knowing that I must work and must sacrifice and must serve to see them answered. But I also say these prayers knowing that an act of prayer itself is a source of strength. It's a reminder that our time on earth is not just about us. And when we open ourselves to the possibility that God might have a larger purpose for our lives, there's a chance that somehow, in ways that we may never fully know, God will use us well." Now, you know, almost any Christian I can think of from whatever denomination would agree wholeheartedly with that prayer, you know, or with that speech about how Barack Obama's talking about asking for forgiveness for his sins and praying and recognizing God as a source of strength. This is all stuff that Christians would agree on. So why was there from some quarters this kind of claim that he isn't a real Christian or even that he's a Muslim?
Well, so it's important to sort of break it down. So... he's a political figure, so some of it was just politics.
Right.
Some of it was, you know, people who didn't like the president generally. If you asked them if he had shot JFK, they would have said yes. it's just it's sort of an emotive type of thing. There was... so it's important. It wasn't just conservatives who questioned his faith. Bill Maher, the liberal atheist talk show host in America, said repeatedly on his show that the president was a closet atheist, that clearly no one as smart as him could be a Christian. And this is while Bill Maher is critiquing conservatives who are questioning the president's faith, and B, as the president's super PAC in 2012 was accepting $1 million donation from Bill Maher, the same guy who was questioning his faith, and so it was happening on both sides, obviously with different motives.
Yes.
Bill Maher meant it as a compliment,
right?
and conservatives not so much, but then I try to discuss in the book what legitimate grounds there were for the for the average American to look and say something doesn't seem right to
me. Sure, yeah. We'll mention a few of those as we go. But, you know, one nice place to start, perhaps, is I was really fascinated to read that one of your first sort of jobs, I guess, in the White House was to scope out a possible church for the first family, for Barack Obama, his wife, children, to all go to a church somewhere in D.C. And so I've got this brilliant image of you. I think you were driving around just, you know, kind of church shopping and making notes on what these various churches were like, which I just think is wonderful. And I'd love to hear a bit more about that. But of course, the key point is that you gave him a list of churches and he didn't join any of them.
Yeah. So it was a surreal experience. I mean, so I'm 20 years old at this time. I had to get a zip car, basically a rental car, because I didn't have a car in D.C. I have a list of nine churches, I think it was. And I'm driving all around D.C. In the stillness of a weekend morning. And going to these churches, look at the flyer, see what I could get, kind of if I could subtly ask around about the kids' ministries and that kind of thing. Yeah. Check out if the choir was good, because the president loves a good church choir.
Okay.
And so just the experience itself was surreal. And, you know, as a Christian, I took it wasn't just sort of a staffing responsibility. It was it was potentially, this is where the first family is going to be receiving teaching and being in Christian community. So it was a serious thing. I describe in the book the challenges of taking any president to church.
The logistical
challenges, that not just the challenges it places on the White House, but most importantly, the challenges it places on the congregation. So if the president goes to your church, that means that you have to arrive 90 minutes early. Everyone has to be screened through security. I tell a story the first time the president-elect, when he was president-elect Obama, went to church in December of 2008 for, I think, the week before Christmas. He went to a historically black church in Washington, D.C., and unfortunately, the news leaked out of where he was going the night before. So I get to the church in the morning to staff the event, and all of the folks who belong to the church that are dressed up in their Sunday finest and are outside the church and can't get in, while all of these tourists, white guys with Hawaiian shirts on, who just wanted a glimpse of the president-elect, were taking up their seats in the service. They didn't care about worshiping. They didn't care about any of that.
Yeah.
And so there are legitimate reasons President Bush went to St. John's sometimes, but he didn't go to church regularly. Mm-hmm. The Clintons actually did have a home church when they were in office. Reagan did not attend church regularly. Yeah. And so it's been a common problem.
Sure.
But the average American, I think, looked at that and thought, well, I'm a Christian. I go to church every week. Why, if he's a Christian, why wouldn't he?
Yeah. And there is some truth in that, in the sense that some Christians would say, look, I appreciate it's a logistical nightmare, but come on, as Christians, isn't this a big part of our faith? He should have done it.
Now that I'm out, I'll say I wasn't a disinterested sort of observer.
Sure.
Here's something, a good general rule to apply was that if you have people in your life, let me say it this way, if there are people in your life that identify as Christians, but you maybe see some areas in their life that could use some improvement.
Sure.
Your approach is to encourage them and to spur them on, as Paul says.
Yeah.
And when that same level of grace and Christian commitment isn't shown to someone that you don't even know, so I would laugh when and be sad when, you know, conservative pastors in America would say that Barack Obama wasn't a Christian because he held this or that policy view. And I looked at their church and said, well, hold on, you're a pastor overseeing a church. I don't see you kicking out people of your church for holding different political views. So it seems like you're using your position as pastor to make a political critique of a president that for good reason you're not applying in your own congregation. Yeah.
Now, for me as a Christian, it's also a sacred union. You know, God is in the mix. That's what he said. And this kind of evolution was much discussed because he did reference his faith as a reason for why he was opposed at that point to same-sex marriage. But then, of course, he did change his mind. And again, he used religious language. He talked about the golden rule. He talked about how treating others as you'd want to be treated. And he says, I've evolved on this subject. I now believe that marriage should be open to gay and lesbian couples. And I think you seem to be quite critical of this U-turn in the book. Because it has since been suggested that Obama probably always believed in same-sex marriage. He just pretended otherwise in order to not upset people at the time. It was perhaps more difficult to hold that view. So he kind of pretended and even used this religious language. And I guess, you know, for a lot of people, it would be very uncomfortable, not only that he was, in effect, lying about what he really thought, but he was using this religious language to justify an opinion that he didn't really hold. It's quite strange, isn't it?
Well, it was very difficult but necessary to write that chapter.
Mm.
And so, I mean, you basically described the chapter that I wrote.
Mm.
And yes, it's very troubling. I think for those, my hope and the reason I wrote the chapter the way I did is that there is, no matter what you think about the issue of gay marriage, if you can't wrestle with, if you can't put your views on the position he ultimately took to the side to be able to look at what is, I'll just use the word, the deception that was at play, the apparent deception. If he wants to come out and say that David Axelrod was lying, and really that's not even an option. He just gave an interview with Rolling Stone where he talked about how methodical he was he confirmed what I wrote in the book, which wasn't publicly confirmed when I wrote it.
Right.
But that I described was my perspective working there, that his efforts to advance things like hospital visitation and then repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell were all about sort of building a narrative to get where he ultimately wanted to go. And so it's a significant
problem.
He
has basically admitted then, you used the word deception, but he's basically admitted that.
Well, yeah. And that's a significant problem. It is a major, how can you have a democracy if people advance themselves up for election holding a position they know that they don't have? That's why these chapters were very difficult for me to write. But you can't condemn cynicism in politics and talk about how the cynics are wrong and we need to have hope in politics and not just mislead people about your position on a core issue that if they didn't think was important to their political success, they would have never bothered misleading people about it. But then to invoke your faith adds a whole other layer that for Christians leads to legitimate questions that is not just sort of no pun intended, but sort of trumped up conspiracy theories.
And I think it feeds into this idea, which of course you in your life have been against, but you know, this idea that politics is a dirty game and Christians shouldn't be involved.
Right.
As I say, you know, the whole point of the book and you talking to me today, of course, is to say that Christians should be involved in this area. And even when it is a dirty game, we have to be salt and light and we have to be involved. And you finish the book by talking about hope and how your ultimate hope isn't actually in politics, but it's in something far higher than that. And I imagine that was a thought that kind of sustained you at times, I would have thought.
Yes.
Going through some of the things you did in the White House, sort of having that sense of perspective, was that helpful?
Yes, it was a perspective I had going in, but there's a big difference between having a theological, intellectual understanding of a concept and actually living through it.
Mm.
And the main reason I wrote this book is because it's important for the reader out there to walk through what I walked through and to see that you can go through whether it's the experiences I went through and that America has gone through over the last 8 years, whether it's the next 4 years of a Trump administration, whether it's Brexit, whatever the political controversy is, that you can move through these difficult times with an enduring hope that is grounded in things that are more real than politics, more real than Scripture says the powers and principalities, and that is the Christian claim.
Yeah.
The Christian claim is that these things are passing away, and that is not just sort of a rhetorical comfort. That is not something that that we tuck our kids in bed at night. For Christians, we believe it is a statement of reality. Mm. It is a statement of truth, and that's why it's important to proclaim it, especially at a time when there are so many people proclaiming both false hopes and claiming that there's no hope at all. Mm. We know that the answer is far different.
Absolutely. You mentioned him already, of course, but we've got to talk about the president-elect, Donald Trump. And I guess I want to frame this by thinking back to just after he won the election, and there was that sit-down meeting between Obama and Donald Trump. And it was remarkable to watch because both of these men had said, frankly, pretty, I don't want to say outrageous, but very, very strong words about the other. And there they were shaking hands in what looked like quite an awkward kind of press conference. You know, both these men knowing exactly what they'd said about the other. I think Obama said that Trump was deeply unqualified to be president, and Trump obviously had talked about Barack Obama not even, not even being an American citizen and all the sort of birth certificate controversy and everything else. So, and yet there they were, showing some kind of unity coming together. And I just wonder, do you feel like that is a picture of what now needs to happen? These kind of two completely opposing sides now have to kind of kiss and make up, to use a strange phrase. Is that what now needs to happen?
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a heartening to see it that, in a very different time, President Obama reaffirmed his commitment to the same types of ideals he talked about in 2004. And so, and he's received some criticism for it.
What kind of ideals?
The idea that democracy is not about any single one of us. And that politics can be a place of selfless service. Mm. And so when he says to Donald Trump in that meeting that his highest priority for the next 2 months is making sure that Donald Trump is set up for success, because if he succeeds, America succeeds, that is not the general tone and tenor that the progressive movement in America was or is taking towards Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah.
So it was a powerful act of statesmanship, and I have never been prouder. I had some significant. I don't think we'll have time to get in. I had some significant criticisms of Hillary Clinton during the 2016 campaign. I have never been prouder of her, and more impressed with her leadership than the speech she gave the morning after the election, where she. She affirmed her support for the peaceful transition of power and said some deeply moving things about her hopes for the future of the country. And so yes, that is where we need to go. Now, that is not to say, President-elect Trump has already made some decisions that are grounds for legitimate, serious concern. Some of the policy statements that he's made are worthy of criticism, and we should critique those wholeheartedly. The reason why Christians need to be involved in politics is that we have resources to draw on that equip us to engage in politics, not for ourselves, but for others.
Yeah.
And that is, other people can engage in politics that way, but there are resources unique to Christians, security in Christ, that empowers us to do that. And that's what our politics needs right now, because right now we have a very self-interested model of political engagement that is not healthy for the country.
That's very interesting, and it kind of brings me on to this next question about religious freedom.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that when a lot of people, I think both Christians in this country and in America, when we talk about religious freedom, what we often are thinking about is Christian freedom.
That's right.
Which is understandable. I mean, especially internationally, you see how Christians are being persecuted, and it is a deep and genuine concern. But I want to talk about religious freedom when it comes to the US.
Yeah.
Or the UK, you know, not in Syria, not in Iraq, but what does religious freedom mean in a democracy like the US or the UK? Because there's been an incident, for example, in Northern Ireland with the gay cake story of these Christian bakers, you know, refusing to make a cake that said support gay marriage on it. And I understand that there is a feeling in parts of the US from some Christians who feel like they're being marginalized. Who feel like they're under attack in some way. And I just wanted to know from your perspective if you feel like that is a legitimate concern right now for American Christians to feel like Christianity is under some kind of attack in the U.S.
So I don't use the language of attack, but what's very clear, and I've spent much of the last decade working on religious freedom issues, is that religious freedom is increasingly under pressure in America. And that is for a number of reasons: rising secularization, the fact that certain issues of social progress are at tension with certain religious communities' beliefs. So as public policy advances those social issues, religious freedom kind of ends up as collateral damage. And so, yes, it's a significant concern. I would suggest a few things. One is that religious freedom is an inclusive principle, and if it's not advanced by an inclusive coalition, then the claim to it is rightly viewed with suspicion by non-Christians. And so you cannot advocate for the religious freedom of the cake baker and then protest a mosque opening up down the street. It's discord. You can't have it. What you're arguing for then is Christian privilege, not religious freedom.
Religious
freedom. And here's why Christians don't need to be concerned about religious freedom for other religious communities, which is to return to what I just said, which is that we're not Christians because it's our tribe. It's not our football team. We're not looking to claim we are Christians because we believe it reflects reality, and therefore we have no concern about allowing a freedom of a religious marketplace of ideas to operate, and that's what we should defend. I'll tell you, I've become increasingly convinced that the fate of religious freedom, and Christians should view it this way, is intimately tied to the future of Islam in Western world. And that if we don't see and view sincerely the religious claims of Muslims, obviously, right, I'm not talking about imposition of Sharia law and all of this, right? Like, we use these crazy examples. But if we don't view with sincerity the religious freedom claims of Muslims, then I don't know how sustainable it will be for the religious freedom of Christians to be respected. That may not be how it should play out, but given the political circumstances, given the cultural trends, that is a practical political concern that Christians need to have.
Yeah. There are, and we've touched on some of them already, there are some very interesting similarities between our two nations on politics and religion. There's also some very key differences. And given that you're in the UK, I wondered if you had any thoughts on where we're at as Christians living in the democracy that we have here under the leadership that we have here.
Yes.
Similarities and of course both the incoming president and the outgoing president. And our outgoing Prime Minister and our incoming current Prime Minister all have professed a Christian faith. but what are your thoughts on the UK climate when it comes to politics and religion?
Yeah, it's an interesting time in Europe. One difference is America still feels like it hasn't tested... is still trying to shed sort of what it views as religious baggage, still trying to test sort of a secularization of liberal democratic values. Here in the UK, and I'd say in Germany as well, y'all are a little further ahead of us on secularization. And I'm beginning to see a sort of questioning, even among non-believers, of whether a secular expression of values like egalite, fraternite, whether secular expressions of those values, the secular expressions of human rights, are strong enough to sustain themselves in an increasingly conflict-driven, diverse, contested world. And so... you know, you see someone like Chancellor Merkel say that the problem in Germany is not too much Islam, but too little Christianity.
Right.
That she said our Christians are not Christian enough, right, which is a profound thing to say. Yeah. You've seen even from the U.S., it was heartening to see some of what Prime Minister Cameron had to say about the productive role that faith could play in British society. And so I'm seeing a cracks in some of the secular assumptions that had been made in the latter part of the 20th century, and perhaps a time to reopen some of those questions.
How interesting. Well, Michael, you've had an absolutely fascinating career already. Not many people have worked in the White House and you know, work so closely with you know, arguably the most powerful person in the world. So what's next for you? Where do you go from here?
Well, you know, so right now, so I have a consulting practice. I help Christian organizations navigate public issues, and then I help secular organizations that share a common goal with the faith community advance that goal. And so I've worked on many issues, including religious freedom and nuclear disarmament, and it's just been a lot of fun these last few years with my company. But some of that is kind of on hold right now while I take this book to the public. This book is my passion project. It's a book of conviction. It wasn't an easy book to write, but I really it's I believe in it more strongly now than I did when I embarked on the project, and so I'll be focusing on that. And then I care deeply about the future of the church, and so whatever role I find myself in after the book comes out and sort of as I continue in my career, I would be surprised if it did not involve helping the church navigate what I think is a very pivotal period for the long-term sort of position of the church in our countries.
Absolutely. Well, it's been fascinating to talk. Thank you so much for coming in. The book, once again, if people want to get hold of it, it's called Reclaiming Hope. It's by Michael Weir, and it's subtitled Lessons Learned in the Obama White House about the Future of Faith in America. It is out now, so go and get a copy. But Michael, thank you so much for coming in and being with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.